Accession number 23100, reel 10.
Going back to your evaluation task, how did you propose to set about that investigation with Germany in chaos? Did you have a game plan for how you were going to go about it?
We had decided, first of all, to visit all the concentration camps. Whether we knew our agent had been there or not, have a look at the records, if there were records available. They weren't always available, and check what were available, and ask questions, and find out what was maybe behind the surface. Some folks were quite keen to talk, some weren't. Go down to the American zone and go to Wiesbaden and check what they had done, because they'd actually entered several camps on their side of the border and discuss with them. And I got these damn great sheaves of movement orders, and then go to the camps on their side too and search through the records as far as we could.
Talk
to CIC.
Did you have a great long list of names that you would...
We had a card index, yes, of names, and suggested that they probably would be in so-and-so, so-and-so. And it was difficult. The one thing that emerged was the finding of those six girls in Karlsruhe, from which they were dispatched to various concentration camps.
How did that come about?
We were down in Karlsruhe, and we went to inquire about a supposed detention camp in the area. And I think I went last day to the German police and asked them. And they it was who told me that there was one of the wardresses, or guards, wardresses, I think they could, alive in the city. And she might be able to help me. And then, of course, we discovered this woman, and she openly said, yes, there were six girls came here, and they came off the train, and that was the first indication we had. I sent it to London immediately and left it to them to issue further instructions. Because it didn't. She had no idea where they went, but I sent immediately. They left Karlsruhe, according to this woman, and...
And who would you have been sending information back to in London?
Tom Wells. He was the official rear link at that time. And of course the final rear link was Norman Mott. But Tom Wells was our rear link, to whom we reported directly. And my reports, as reports, were sent to Archie. The written reports went to Archie, but I kept Tom Wells informed of all that was going on. And no doubt Archie gave him my reports in due time. But the reports went directly to Archie, and Tom Wells was the rear link, official rear link.
Because you seem to have travelled, just briefly looking at your diary, I mean that you were travelling non-stop, weren't you?
Mark, we travelled through the night sometimes, because we just didn't have time. And we ate on the roadside more often than not. And poor Valerie Gibson had a hell of a rough time when she was sent out to join me, but she turned up trumps. The last I heard of Valerie Gibson was when I went to London from business. I used to get in touch with her, take her out for a meal, and the last time I saw her was, I think, 1955, and she just managed to fix up a job as a very pathetic stenographer with the Foreign Office, travelling between Singapore, Rangoon and Bangkok. I have no further knowledge of Valerie Gibson at all, but she was looking forward to this, because she was a good lass, and she'd manage to travel all right.
Because one gets the feeling of not only were you having to travel a lot, but your travelling conditions and the accommodation was terribly, terribly difficult.
It wasn't easy, but the Americans were quite good. They did help. We had... Did you read that journey with Vera? We couldn't get in anywhere. Coming back from Recklinghausen, and she was going to storm in, and Falmer sitting in the back. She thought that she was still running her section. So I'll go in and talk to these people. We must have a meal. We can't starve. Our food packet was stolen in Recklinghausen in the campsite. We came away with food packet. And when we went, and after the final interrogation had ended, we went back to the car for our food parcels.
So when did you first get a glimmer of the fact that there was somebody else replicating your endeavours, or perhaps having a slightly different agenda to your endeavours?
Well, the first indication, of course, was that SARS business in May. And we came across this chap, Captain Young, I think his name was, sitting with his parachute badge, trying to get leave to take away Agustin and the other chap. And he hadn't a clue what to do with it. He just didn't understand. He was going to summer lift with the American bombers that were going westwards with two unknown bods. And of course I have them on a movement order there, not listed as named, but two others.
And you hadn't been told about the activities of SARF?
No, we just knew that Ted Sheridan was setting up this thing. We didn't know he was cutting across our lines until I came across this fellow Young, and I realised then that they had no backup. Not that I had much backup either. At least we knew the form. We knew how to get round authority and how to get these chaps out of Germany by legal means, not by lift.
And the SARS?
They'd be RLL when they got to the UK. That would be the upshot. They'd just be RLL, that's that.
I got, you see, the interesting thing as well is that SARF I didn't see as an investigative unit, but one of resourceful, redoubtable individuals who would help defend prisoners from Nazi retribution.
This was the role as we understood it. We had no idea that they were given a free hand to do what they liked. It just so happened that I turned up and found that Agustin and this other chap were there, and that this little captain was sitting in their company, actually. He had been, I think, conducting officer at a time when Agustin was in a party, and he'd recognised the man. That's the only reason he picked him up, because he recognised who he was. At least he recognised he'd seen him before. And then he was sitting with this chap and this other bod, wondering what the hell to do with him.
And what about Vera? When did you first get word of, or get any intimation of her existence, perhaps, never mind her...
November 1945, I came back for a discussion with Archie, and Vera came into the picture, because she was hoping to come out to Germany, and she hoped I'd be able to help her. I wasn't given any indication what she was going to do, but she was hoping to have a post-war, and she hoped I'd be able to help her. When she came out to Germany, she had certain things in mind. And of course, when she came, the first thing in her mind was this man Jumeau, who was somewhere or other up in Bush. But behind the whole facade, there was this Francis Kamertz to get me a post somehow. And then she'd already been in touch with Sommerhoff, War Crimes in London, because they were the ones who had said, we'd be able to provide you with an opportunity to interview Kindle. I knew nothing about this. Kindle and Surin, and they laid it on.
See, this is very interesting, because it's always been represented to me that Vera's activities were in part inspired not merely by her own drive, but by the fact that were she not to do it, no one was going to be doing it. And yet...
Well, I think this is Vera's offer. Nobody else can do it but me, because I knew all these people. And I'm prepared to go and search after them, and also take part in any war crimes missions that may be arising in which I could play my part. Vera was the sole person in her life who could do this. She probably did it very well, I'm quite sure she did. I couldn't go and tackle Surin and Kindle. I wasn't briefed to do that. But she wasn't briefed when she came with Isla.
So you therefore, when you were told that in London that Vera of F section, Vera Atkins of F section, was going to be pursuing an investigation mm-hmm. of F section agents, and that you were to render her assistance you could.
Well, she'd more knowledge than I had. My knowledge was second hand, but she'd personal, first hand knowledge of these people, and could contribute something which I couldn't do. So I didn't object to that at all. But then she did turn up on St. Andrew's night, and I just said, no, the hell with you. I'm going to dance Highland Satish first. And then, of course, there was this strange under-the-counter business about Jumeau, first of all. And then she did reveal she really came to see Francis Camerts, and then she spent the whole of the weekend with Francis Camerts. And then, as I said yesterday, on Monday morning, Sunday night when she came back from Camerts, I have an appointment tomorrow at 10 o'clock with Group Captain Sommerhoff at Bad Oeynhausen. 10 o'clock? Good God, why the hell didn't you say this yesterday? 276 miles. You haven't talked open later at 5 o'clock in the morning. She didn't know what 5 o'clock was. But she just brushed it and said, oh, well, I'll tell the group captain I've been delayed. Then she'd no idea where he was, except he was somewhere in Bad Oeynhausen.
Had you had any dealings with Samar yourself?
No. No, none at all. He was purely war crimes, and that wasn't my remit.
So when Vera appears, you are, a facilitator to her...
Literally just a driver, that was all.
Did she confide in you as to what she was doing and why she was doing it?
No, she simply said that she was hoping to do a post-war job, and then it emerged in conversation that this was all tied up with Francis Camerts getting her introductions here and there, which he probably could do, I've no doubt. But her main function, I want to go to Buch, Russian zone of law. And then there came this weekend flitting off with Francis, for whatever reason, I don't know. And then there came this, I have an appointment with Group Captain Sommerhoff at Bad Oeynhausen at 10 o'clock. I got bits and pieces, piecemeal. First of all, Jumeau, get me the book. And then this other do. And then Francis Camerts inviting us to have lunch in the Halfwell's, and that fell through. And then Francis Camerts' invitation to meet and dine with him and his friends, that fell through. And then there's something, I want to get to Bad Oeynhausen by 10 o'clock. Well, I'm sure she had it all in her mind.
It appears from my perspective that you do have a bit of a problem there, that you've got two people working, well, you've got different
but
agendas.
But you didn't know that, you see. Vera was working with Sporborg and Dibley, and they'd worked out that they were going to have this mission post-war, and there was no room for two G2s, and she was appointed, when I met her, she was still flight officer, but she was to be appointed squadron officer, and she was going to lead whatever this might be. And as for DCE and his bloody mission, he got a petition.
Did Boyle ever seek to confront Spielberg?
He was at the meeting when this was finally discussed, and it was all already pre-arranged by Spielberg and Dibley, and that was Archie's, Mr. Corrigan to Archie, that was his first indication that this had all been predetermined and worked out, and there was no room for two G2s, and one was made up quickly to a G2, and she was to be the boss, and they couldn't afford two. So DCE and ECD in his evaluation wish to go to perdition. It was all carefully connived. The same thing was this question of the MBE or the GC going around the corners to Venner and getting Venner to help for this and help for that, and Spielberg as well. Vera was a very conniving girl, a very able girl, and she did a very good job. I have nothing but respect for what she did. She did a great job. But her methods, I couldn't stomach them.
And you say that when you witnessed her conducting two interrogations, Kindl and Surin. I mean, you said that you weren't a, you wouldn't class yourself as the interrogator that perhaps was existing at Bayswater. Did she know what she wanted out of these interrogations?
My feeling was she wasn't prepared. She didn't have a dossier of the questions she wanted to ask in the order she wanted to ask them. She just shot out questions, leading questions, which gave away the fact that she was looking for information on this particular aspect. She should have gone round the subject, but she didn't. She just blurted out from time to time, straight, and he just... nothing about it. He didn't budge. That man was a true soldier.
This is Kindl? Or Surin?
Kindl was a maybe pimp. No, Surin was a real soldier. Never flinched from straight attention from the time he came in, from the time we got rid of him. And again, when we brought him back again, still stood his attention. The only time he started was when I talked about the crematorium. And Violette Jabot and Lillian and Denise bodies were put in the crematorium.
But he was a sharp cookie as well, and was presumably, because he would have also known that any confession was signing his own death warrant.
Of course. But my grouse was that she came out knowing she was going to interview Sarah, and yet she had his two suitcases lying somewhere in London, brought back by Odette, with all his dirty pants, his family photographs, his personal Walter pistol. I was surprised to find that in amongst his suitcase, but I suppose that was a second insurance, maybe.
And that is... And Vera told you that this material had
Oh, yes, she told me that this had all been looked through and searched. But it never occurred to the... No, you see, this Kindl business was, I think, of second-rate importance to her trying to get herself established post-war, finding the right contacts. And Sommerhoff was one, of course, because he was war crimes. And Francis had avenues of exploration in Berlin, who probably would be helpful to her too. Give Vera credit. Vera had it all worked out in her mind, but she had these two important jobs to find Jumo's grave. I must find that for his family. Didn't matter a damn for Jumo's grave, really. And the other thing was that she was going to interview Surin and Kindl, but she hadn't done any preparation. She'd done no homework.
Kindl being the commandant of
Sachsenhausen.
Were you and she looking for lists of agents you knew to be in Sachsenhausen?
We knew there were agents in Sachsenhausen, and we knew more about the agents in Ravensbrück. But she didn't really... It wasn't really my place to... I didn't know anything about this bloody show, so I couldn't really butt in. I had no background information. I knew there were agents in Sachsenhausen from my own lists, but I didn't have the knowledge that she had as to who they were in the French section, for example, all their background in the French section. She knew all about them. But she didn't pursue that at all. She just simply said that you had British people in your camp. And we kind of just... he was useless. Utterly useless.
It's interesting, you know, that Sigismund Payne Best, about whom we spoke yesterday, mm-hmm. thought that Kindl was a wonderful man.
Did he?
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, perhaps with some qualifications, but he felt that Kindl treated him in an appropriate manner when he was in Sachsenhausen. So the thing about Best...
Kindl was, of course, in what you might call fatigues when we saw him, but I gathered that he was an imposing figure in the camp, imposing insofar that he was barely 5 feet, but he had these 5-inch heels on his Hauptstiefel, and he had this enormous peak cap, high peak cap, so that gave him an apparent height of somewhere around 5'8" or 9". And he may have been, he had a apparently impeccable uniform. Everything highly polished and whatever possible, silver frogs and everything else, everything was there, and medals or whatever was he wore. He made a very imposing figure, I gather, in his magnificent uniform, because he'd no inches to dominate people. It all had to be what you saw.
Were you able to secure any Gestapo files or paperwork whilst you were in Germany?
No. By the time we got to Berlin, everything was rifled, or I hope British troops had been in before me, but all that I got was odd bits and pieces of, I had some stenographer's notebooks, there's one lying there somewhere or other, I have two of these, and...
You did visit the Prince Albrechtstrasse. Hmm? You did visit the Prince Albrechtstrasse.
Yes. We did a complete tour and rifling what we could, but there was nothing left to rifle because it was all, as I said yesterday, miles and miles of film just crushed on the floor in Goering's room. Maybe they were probably all Goering's appearances here, there and yon, I don't know. I did pick up Goering's own book, which is in that wee bookcase outside in the hall there.
His own book.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have a look in a minute. So to go back to this split between yourself and what you were doing and that of Vera and others, mm-hmm. when did you realise that the writing was on the wall for your own particular mission?
I felt that when this general conniving was taking place between Robin Brook and Van, because Van was obviously involved in this too, he had several conversations with Robin Brook and others as well, the German section was aware of this. I mean, talking about the evaluation missioner, the German section was aware of this possible link-up, and they rather favoured it, quite frankly. But I felt that we were being let down by this slowly absorption of our function. Not my function, my evaluation function was quite secure, but our German function was being absorbed into this new organisation, which didn't bode any good for me, and I wasn't quite sure it boded good for X section either, but that was not my problem. And then when I came back, saw Archie, and he said, well, I think there's not much future. And I said, are you staying on? No, he said, I'm not, I've had enough. And I said, if you stay on, I would like to stay on. And he said, no. And then he told me that there might be a job with Perkins, and there might be a job elsewhere as well. I gather Munn emerged at that point and had asked for my particulars, I don't know anything about this, but there was a girl called Margaret Robertson who was on that side, Munda side, and on one of my trips back in November, I ran across her. And she said, "Oh, your ears should be burning." "Well, it's a cold day." "I've just seen comments on you from Colonel Munn. Your ears should be burning, really burning." What that meant, I don't know. I never had any other contact or hint. But he seems to have been involved also. But I decided by then that I was going home. Not enough.
That whole period of the winding down or the severance of SOE is one that we're only now beginning to get a few more details upon because of the opening up of the files.
Yes, of course.
I would imagine that more would be found in SIS files, but we won't get to see those.
Yes. And they were the motivating force.
Yes. Did you have any dealings with their representatives in Germany when you were carrying out your activities?
No, not. We came across Robin Brook from time to time, and we came across one or two others who dropped in to our mess.
I saw you mentioned John Bruce Lockhart in one of your...
Oh, yes, John. John was a student with us, of course.
Was he?
He was younger than me, John Bruce Lockhart. Mm-hmm. He got awfully pouchy. Pouchy and paunchy when I met him. I was a bit surprised. He was a great rugby player, John. His brother followed on from St Andrews. He married a girl called Margaret Hone. Her father was Bishop of Ripon, I think it was. She's still alive.
But that whole period of SOE's end, but also that absorption of SOE staff and practice and procedures and techniques and so on, we can get as historians, we can get a perspective. But as I say, I think given that there is an understandable disinclination to emphasise the position of those people who did make the transition, I think that'll have to wait for a day.
Well, mm-hmm.
When you finally, so presumably you decided you'd had enough, or the thing was closed down?
I decided there was no future, except with Perkins. But I've never really liked Perkins. I had nothing much to do with his section at all. I didn't know the man, but I didn't have much time for him. He had an interesting career with us. He had a senior commander who was very important in his section. No, he offered me a job and I said, "I'm sorry, but I think I'm going back to business." And that was that. There was a suggestion earlier, much earlier on, that Vernon Sainsbury, is that ring a bell with you?
Only in reading some of your diaries.
He was over at Maine on the I side. And I don't know anything about this, but he left a message when I was away swanning around. I use that word in the proper sense, not in Robin Brooks' sense, that he wanted me to go and see him. And I got in touch with his office, and I learned that he had a job for me. But I never heard any more, and he vanished very shortly afterwards, so my job vanished with him. Not that I would have accepted it necessarily at all, but I think it was probably promotion at Maine, which I don't think I would have accepted that. I enjoyed what I was doing. I think we were doing a reasonably good job, and I had all the support of Valerie Gibson in every sense, because she had a tough time, and she roughed it willingly.
And she was a Fanny?
She was a Fanny captain. Mm-hmm. Been in Massingham. Clocks in France, a bad driver, very bad driver, but she confessed to me that she'd actually rammed a Paris tram car with a traction of all. I said, that must have coloured your driving, Valerie, because you've never forgotten it. She had gimlet vision.
Gimlet vision, what's that?
She never saw what was round the corner or the side of anywhere else. Didn't even see bumps in the road. But no, she's a nice girl. Her father was a vicar of the Anglican Church in Brompton. And there was a brother and another sister, Angela, who contacted me in Edinburgh after the war from a historical point of view. Nothing to do with SOE. And then he was translated to Brighton. And I don't know what happened after that, because the war had ended. And as I said, the last time I saw